Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Susan Shand, Katie Weaver, and Pete Musto. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
For many Americans, monarch butterflies are a sign of changing seasons. In the late summer and early autumn, the butterflies fly south from Canada and the United States mainland to Mexico. But Darlene Burgess still keeps seeing the bright, colorful insects, and she lives in Canada. Burgess keeps counts of monarch butterflies at Point Pelee National Park in Ontario. As nice as this is to see, I really wish I wouldn't see it because they're running out of time, she said. It's really not good for them. Monarchs are not just staying in Canada. Groups of them have been seen north of the Mexican border, such as the American state of New Jersey. Their large numbers are not normal for late October. Monarchs normally arrive in Mexico around November 1st. The number of stragglers in Canada and the U.S. is definitely new territory for us, said Chip Taylor, a biology professor at the University of Kansas. He also is the director of Monarch Watch, an organization that studies the butterflies. There are a few reasons why the monarchs did not fly south when they were supposed to. Some monarchs were born late. Some did not move south because of warm weather. Others could not fly south because of strong winds that lasted for weeks. Now, they may be stuck because temperatures are starting to fall. Elizabeth Howard is a biologist and director of a nonprofit group called Journey North. She said the monarch's muscles do not work well when temperatures go below 15 degrees Celsius. If the butterflies do not freeze, they are likely to starve to death because many of the plants they eat are gone for the season, Howard noted. Monarchs have faced a number of problems in recent years. Habitat loss, climate change, and chemical pesticides have hurt the butterfly population, said Lincoln Brower, a biology professor at Sweetbriar College. Brower has been studying the butterflies since 1954. The colorful creatures also have a decreasing food supply, especially in the form of milkweeds, which are the only food they can eat when they are caterpillars. Taylor notes that this year may not be as bad as some of the most recent years. The 2013-2014 season was especially bad. Not all is lost, he said. I'm John Russell.
Vietnam's technology startups face a complex question. Now what? The country did not ignore the startup trend of the 21st century, but in the trend's early days, Vietnam was spending more time and energy talking about technology and its promise. Now Vietnam hopes to move to the next step, getting entrepreneurs to meet their economic goals. Startup leaders hope to make a profit expand internationally, or combine their companies with other businesses. Vietnam has a high literacy rate. Its people generally have strong math ability. Both are critical tools for building a technology economy. The country also has a large consumer market, similar to Thailand and the Philippines. And Vietnam has the potential for high growth rates, similar to Laos and Cambodia. Low wages and the low cost of internet service help make Vietnam a good place to build a small business. It might be the perfect environment for technology startups. But Vietnam needs to act. Vietnam usually does copy-paste, said Lum Tran, leader of the startup WisePass. He says the Vietnamese need to move beyond copying a foreign business and recreating it in the Vietnamese market. He says it needs to create inside Vietnam and spread the businesses internationally. WisePass is an app that connects monthly subscribers to restaurant and bar deals. It began in Ho Chi Minh City, and Lum Tran plans to expand to 7 other countries. Using good relationships with border countries is a smart plan, say technology business experts. Vietnamese make up large communities in other countries. These communities can help connect the Southeast Asian country to investors, advisors, and developers in those countries. Also, technology in Vietnam is increasingly sophisticated. The Vietnamese Innovative Startup Accelerator, or VISA, is one example. For a second year, it has invested in 11 startups. These new businesses have partners operating in countries such as Ukraine, South Korea, and France. Sung Yip Khan is an investment officer at Visa partner Hanwha Investment. He said he is pleased with the international reach of this year's group. The foreign teams were able to expand their business in Vietnam while helping Vietnamese companies with global insights, Kang said. He added this was a strong move forward for tech startups in Vietnam. The government of Vietnam is supporting such growth. On January 1st, a new law for startups called Law on Supporting Small and Medium-Sized Enterprises will begin. The law offers new companies financial assistance for office space, equipment, and training. It also provides low interest rate loans. To do more than copy and paste, new businesses must consider how to appeal to Vietnamese people. For example, the startup Bút Chì Mào makes games that are directed toward Vietnam's endless drive for education. Another, Market Oi, uses motorbike drivers to deliver customized food orders. Market Oi founder Germaine Blanchet said the question is how to be different from others. The answer, he believes, is to be flexible. I'm Susan Shand.
The United States is now alone in the world in its rejection of the Paris Climate Agreement. Syria announced it would sign that agreement Tuesday in Bonn, Germany, at the United Nations yearly climate change conference. The treaty calls for individual limits on greenhouse gas releases among participating countries. It is not binding, nor does it provide any enforcement mechanism. Barack Obama signed the treaty in his second term as U.S. president. However, in June, President Donald Trump withdrew the nation from the agreement. He said the agreement hurts the U.S. economy and American workers. At that time, Syria and Nicaragua were the only other countries that had not signed. Nicaragua signed the agreement last month. Environmental organizations around the world praised Syria's decision. But comments on social media were directed more at the United States and Donald Trump. Senator Michael Bennett is a Democrat from the state of Colorado. He tweeted, "Even Syria will join Paris Agreement. This doesn't make America great. It makes us the only country denying the reality of climate change." I'm Katie Weaver.
Mexico City has made changes to its emergency announcement service known as 911-CDMX. The service now sends messages to people's smartphones warning them of earthquakes. The changes come after a magnitude 7.1 earthquake hit Mexico's capital on September 19th. The quake killed 369 people and caused 38 buildings to collapse. Officials announced the new smartphone program last week. Mayor Miguel Angel Mancera said users of the free 911-CDMX program will receive messages for any earthquake strong enough to damage the city. The program will send sound messages and cause the smartphone to vibrate. The governmental center, known as C5, for Command, Control Computing, Communications, and Contact, developed the program. It is available for both iOS and Android smartphone operating systems. Mancera said at a news conference there would be no demonstration of the system to avoid causing any unnecessary worry. "We are not interested in having anyone hear it who does not know the context in which it is being presented," he said. More than 20 million people live in the capital and surrounding area. Many buildings there are built on a former lake bottom. Its soil can increase the effects of earthquakes, which are centered far away. Shockwaves from such earthquakes may arrive at the city later. Early in September, an earthquake that was stronger than the one that hit Mexico City was centered hundreds of miles away. The United States Geological Survey recently changed the record of its magnitude from 8.1 to 8.2, and many people in the capital felt it strongly. Mexico City already has a system of loudspeakers that give out a warning whenever a serious earthquake is detected. Idris Rodriguez Zapata is the general coordinator for C5. He urged residents to put the new 911-CDMX program on their smartphones. He also said they should pay attention to earthquake instructions at the moment they hear announcements on the loudspeakers or their phones. Mancera said there had been reports of people setting their smartphone ringtones to the sound of the new earthquake warning. He urged them not to do so to avoid causing worry. The 911 CDMX program has other uses. It lets users see messages about earthquake activity on the website Twitter. It also can put them in contact with an emergency worker and lets them register their blood type and medical history. I'm Pete Musto.
Today on The Making of a Nation, we look at the history of early American Indians. Here is Steve Ember.
The native peoples of North and South America came from Siberia thousands of years ago. There was a land bridge between Siberia and Alaska before the end of the last ice age. As the groups settled different parts of the land, they developed their own cultures and religions. Each group's story is important in the history of the Americas. But our story today will focus on the tribes in what became the central part of the United States. In 1804, Meriwether Lewis and William Clark led a group of explorers to the Pacific Ocean. They met the tribes of the Great Plains. The explorers were perhaps the first white people these Native Americans had ever seen. When the group of explorers neared the eastern side of the Rocky Mountains, they encountered the Shoshone tribe. Meriwether Lewis was the first to see them. Imagine for a moment that we are with Meriwether Lewis near the Rocky Mountains. Across a small hill, a group of 60 Shoshone men are riding toward us. The first thing we see is that these men are ready for war. Each is armed with a bow and arrow. Some carry long poles with a sharp knife at the end. They are riding very fast. Some of the horses look like they do not have riders. But as they get closer, we see that the riders are hanging off the sides of the horses or under the neck. They are using the horses' bodies for protection. The horses are painted with many different designs in blue, black, red, and other colors. Later, we learn that each design has a special meaning for the man who owns the horse. Each one tells a story. For example, the rider of one of the horses is a leader in battle. Another has killed an enemy. As they come nearer, the Shoshone group sees that we are not ready for war. They slow their horses, but are still very careful. Meriwether Lewis holds up an open hand as a sign of peace. The leader of the Shoshone does the same. They come closer. The Shoshone are dressed in clothes made from animal skins. Most of these skins are from deer or buffalo. The skins also have designs and tell stories like the designs on the horses. One design shows that someone has fought in a battle. Another shows that the person has been in many raids to capture horses. Still another shows that someone saved the life of a friend. Meriwether Lewis smiles at these men. He and the Shoshone chief cannot speak each other's language. The explorer again makes a sign of peace. and the sign is again returned. One young Shoshone comes near. He gets off his horse. He is tall and looks strong. His hair is long and black. He wears one long bird feather in the back of his hair. His arms have been painted with long lines. We learn that each line represents a battle. There are many lines on his arms. Fortunately, we are able to continue our travels without a need for him to add another line. Many tribes, including the Shoshone, populated the area known as the Great Plains. The land they lived on influenced the lives and cultures of these Indian nations. The plains stretch across the central part of the country and north into Canada and south to Mexico. Even in a car traveling at 100 kilometers an hour, it can take 2 long days of driving to cross the Great Plains. In the east, the plains begin near the Mississippi River and go west to the huge Rocky Mountains. There are big rivers here and deserts. Some areas are so flat that a person can see for hundreds of kilometers. Huge areas of this land were once covered by thick grasses. Those grasses provided food for an animal that made possible the culture of the Indians of the Great Plains. The grass fed the buffalo or bison that were the center of native culture in the Great Plains. The huge animals provided meat for the Indians and much more. They were an important part of the religion of most of the native people of the Great Plains. The Lakota tribe, sometimes called the Sioux, believed that everything necessary for life could be found in the buffalo. The back of the animal provided the thick skins that the Plains Indians used to make their homes. Other parts of the buffalo hide were made into clothing and warm blankets. The bones were made into tools. No part of the animal was wasted. No one knows how many buffalo were in North America when Meriwether Lewis first met the Shoshone, but experts believe there were probably between 60 million and 75 million. Another animal also played an important part in the Indian cultures of the Great Plains. When Native Americans first saw these animals, they called them big dogs or mystery dogs. They had no word for this kind of animal in their languages. We know it as the horse. The horse had long been extinct in North America.
You have to understand that there were horse species here, you know, millions of years ago, but they died out 10,000 years ago, and so no one had seen a horse.
Until the arrival of Christopher Columbus and other Spanish explorers. Emil Hermeni Horses, curator at the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, describes the, at first, frightening sight to the Native Americans.
So what comes back with the Spaniards, with Christopher Columbus on his second voyage, are horses as we know them today, the large animals. And so you can understand that people who had never seen these before, then to see a rider on top of it, dressed in armor, it must have looked like this tank coming at you that you did not know what it was. So of course it struck fear. The Spaniards, the conquistadors capitalized on that, realizing that it was causing fear and confusion, that they actually put bells on here. So even adding that extra level of noise to frighten the natives who never encountered the horse.
Before the introduction of horses to North America, Indians mostly traveled by foot. Traveling long distances was difficult. So was hunting buffalo. The horse greatly changed life for the tribes of the Great Plains. It gave them a new way to travel and to carry food and equipment. It made it easier and safer for them to follow and hunt the buffalo.
Originally, you may have killed one or two buffalo, where if you're on horseback, you'd be able to kill more buffalo.
The Smithsonian's Emil Hermeni Horses, who is a member of the Oglala Lakota.
And with killing more buffalo, you had more meat, you had more resources to make clothing from the hides, and also to make teepees. So things became more and bigger. So you might see a bigger teepee because you had more hides, you were able to kill more buffalo and process it, and so more abundance.
The horse made it possible to attack an enemy far away and return safely. The measure of a tribe's wealth became the number of horses it owned. Spanish settlers rode horses to the small town of Santa Fe, in what is now the southwestern state of New Mexico. They arrived there in about 1609. How Native Americans got their first horses is not known. Perhaps they traded for them, perhaps they captured them. Soon, many tribes were doing both. By the 1750s, all the tribes of the Great Plains had horses. They had become experts at raising, training, and riding them. And they became experts at horse medicine. Indians of the Great Plains could ride a horse by the age of 5. As an adult, a man would have one horse for work. Another would be specially trained for hunting.
A horse would be trained to ride into the herd. You know, and buffaloes are noted as being, although they're huge and their size, but they can turn very quickly. So a horse had to be ready and then be able to anticipate that. So you did have hunting horses that were trained to ride into a herd of buffalo.
And a third would be trained for war. An Indian warrior's success depended on how closely he and his horse worked together.
You wanted to train this horse. I mean, you were one in battle with the horse. When you went into battle, you were a brother, an ally, a comrade. So the horse was trained to fight in close skirmishes.
George Catlin was an artist who traveled in the early American West. He painted many pictures of the Indians and their horses. Catlin said the Plains Indian was the greatest rider the world had ever known. He said the moment an Indian laid a hand on his horse, he became part of the animal. Both the buffalo and the horse were extremely important to the Plains Indians. Because the horse made hunting easier, more time could be spent on other activities, including art. The Plains Indians began to make designs on their clothing and on blankets for their horses. The arrival of white settlers on the Great Plains marked the beginning of the end for the horse and buffalo culture of the Indians. Settlers did not want buffalo destroying their crops. Great numbers of buffalo were killed. By 1885, the Indians of the Great Plains were mostly restricted to areas called reservations.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.